Are you going to take care of this guy or not? That was his way of saying he thought we had given diplomacy enough time. I appreciated Dick's blunt advice. I told him I wasn't ready to move yet. Okay, Mr. President, it's your call, he said. Then he deployed one of his favorite lines. That's why they pay you the big bucks, he said, with a gentle smile. Don Rumsfeld was not as definitive. He assured me the military would be ready if I gave the order. He also warned that we couldn't leave 150,000 troops sitting on Iraq's border forever. The logistical strain of supporting that many forces was immense. At some point, the buildup would lose its coercive value, because Saddam would conclude we weren't serious about sending the troops in. Condi was careful to stay neutral at the NSC meetings, but she gave me her opinion in private. She had been a strong supporter of inspections, but after meeting with Blix and his team, she was convinced Saddam would do nothing but stall. She reluctantly concluded that the only way to enforce the UN resolution would be to use the military option. Colin had the deepest reservations. In a one-on-one meeting in early 2003, he had told me he believed we could manage the threat of Iraq diplomatically. He also told me he was not fully comfortable with the war plans. That did not surprise me. The operation Tommy Franks had conceived would use about a third as many troops as we had in the Gulf War. It marked a stark departure from the belief that America could win wars only by deploying massive, decisive force, commonly known as the Powell Doctrine. I was pleased when Colin told me he had shared his concerns about the plan with Tommy. Colin had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs during Desert Storm, and I was confident Tommy would take his input seriously. While I was still hopeful diplomacy would work, I told Colin it was possible that we would reach the point where war was the only option left. Neither of us wanted war, but I asked if he would support military action as a last resort. If this is what you have to do, he said, I'm with you, Mr. President. On Sunday morning, March 16th, I boarded Air Force One and winged my way to the Azores Islands, a Portuguese territory about two-thirds of the way from Washington to Lisbon. I was headed to a last-minute summit on diplomatic strategy with Tony Blair, José María Aznar, and Prime Minister José Barroso of Portugal. With the French, Germans, and Russians opposed to the second UN resolution, and the Mexicans and Chileans unwilling to provide their votes, we all agreed the diplomatic track had reached its end. We planned to withdraw the second UN resolution Monday morning. That evening, I would give Saddam Hussein and his sons 48 hours to leave the country, a final opportunity to avoid war. Tony's critical vote in Parliament would come Tuesday. He told me he would resign if the vote failed, meaning that Great Britain would withdraw from the military coalition. I never imagined I would be following a British parliamentary vote so closely, let alone pulling for the Labour Party Prime Minister. I shook hands with my friend and his team as we left the Azores. I hope that's not the last time we ever see them, Condi said, on the walk to Air Force One. The flight home was long and quiet. After so much planning and waiting, the moment had arrived. Unless Saddam fled the country, we would be at war in 3 days. I was deeply disappointed that diplomacy had failed. But I had promised the American people, our allies, and the world that we would enforce the UN resolutions. I was not going to break my word. For months, I had solicited advice, listened to a variety of opinions, and considered the counterarguments. Some believed we could contain Saddam by keeping the inspectors in Iraq. But I didn't see how. If we were to tell Saddam he had another chance, after declaring this was his last chance, we would shatter our credibility and embolden him. Others suggested that the threat wasn't as serious as we thought. That was easy for them to say. They weren't responsible for protecting the country. I remembered the shattering pain of 9/11, a surprise attack for which we had received no warning. This time, we had a warning like a blaring siren. Years of intelligence pointed overwhelmingly to the conclusion that Saddam had WMD. He had used them in the past. He had not met his responsibility to prove their destruction. He had refused to cooperate with the inspectors, even with the threat of an invasion on his doorstep. The only logical conclusion was that he was hiding WMD, and given his support of Terra and his sworn hatred of America, there was no way to know where those weapons would end up. Others alleged that America's real intent was to control Iraq's oil or satisfy Israel. Those theories were false. I was sending our troops into combat to protect the American people. I knew the cost would be high, but inaction had a cost too. Given everything we knew, allowing Saddam to stay in power would have amounted to an enormous gamble. I would have had to bet that either every major intelligence agency was wrong, or that Saddam would have a change of heart. After seeing the horror of 9/11, that was not a chance I was willing to take. Military action was my last resort, but I believed it was necessary. The next day, Monday, March 17, 2003, Ambassador John Negroponte withdrew the second resolution at the UN. That night, I addressed the nation from the Cross Hall of the White House. The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing. The next 2 days felt like a week. We did get some good news on Tuesday. Tony Blair had won his vote in Parliament by a solid margin. Great Britain would be at our side. George Tenet and Colin Powell kept me updated on the latest developments with Iraq. Our last-ditch hope was that Saddam would agree to go into exile. At one point, an offer from a Middle Eastern government to send Saddam to Belarus with $1 to $2 billion looked like it might gain traction. Instead, in one of his last acts, Saddam ordered the tongue of a dissident slashed out and left the man to bleed to death. The dictator of Iraq had made his decision. He chose war. On Wednesday morning, I convened the entire National Security Council in the Situation Room, where I gave the order to launch Operation Iraqi Freedom. 6 hours later, I got an unexpected call from Don Rumsfeld. He said that he had something major to discuss. He and George Tenet were on their way to the Oval Office. "What's going on?" I asked when they arrived. "Mr. President," George said, "we think we have a chance to kill Saddam Hussein." What followed was one of the most extraordinary meetings of my presidency. With the full national security team gathered in the Oval Office, advisors scrambled in and out, providing the latest updates from the field. A network of intelligence sources in Iraq reported that Saddam and some of his family were likely to spend the night at a complex outside Baghdad called Dora Farms. If we bombed the site, we might be able to decapitate the regime. I was skeptical. If I ordered the airstrike, we would be departing from our well-conceived plan, which called for 2 days of covert operations before the air war commenced. I pictured all that could go wrong. Two F-117 bombers would have to fly unescorted over a heavily fortified city. My biggest concern was that the intelligence was a trap. What if it was not Saddam headed to Dora Farms, but a busload of kids? The first images of the war would show us killing innocent Iraqi children. The safest course was to stick with the plan. But one thought kept recurring. By killing the dictator, we might be able to end the war before it began and spare lives. I felt a responsibility to seize this opportunity. General Myers briefed me that the planes were gassed up, and the Tomahawk land attack missiles were programmed. I turned to the team gathered in the Oval Office and said, "Let's go." Just after the 48-hour deadline expired, the bombing began. Condi called early the next morning. A witness had seen a man who resembled Saddam being carried out of the rubble at Dora Farms. But as the days passed, the reports changed. The operation was a harbinger of things to come. Our intent was right. The pilots performed bravely. But the intelligence was wrong. The day after the opening shot at Dora Farms, a flurry of military activity commenced. From Iraq's southern border with Kuwait, the 5th Corps and 1st Marine Expeditionary Force started their parallel charge to Baghdad. Meanwhile, our air forces bombarded the capital. In the initial wave of the strike, more than 300 cruise missiles, followed by stealth bombers, took out most of Saddam's military command and government headquarters. Unlike the firebombing of Dresden, the nuclear strikes on Hiroshima or Nagasaki, or the use of napalm on Vietnam, our attack spared much of Baghdad's civilian population and infrastructure. It was not only shock and awe, but one of the most precise air raids in history. In southern Iraq, Marines deployed to protect key oil fields. Polish special forces and U.S. Navy SEALs secured offshore oil infrastructure. A British armored division liberated the southern city of Basra and the vital port of Umm Qasr. The oil fires and sabotage we feared never materialized, and we had cleared a path for humanitarian aid to flow into Iraq. In northern Iraq, paratroopers seized key transit points and helped build an air bridge for supplies and humanitarian aid. With support from Kurdish forces, the Zaqawi camp was destroyed. In western Iraq, American, British, and Australian special forces patrolled the desert for Scud missiles and made sure Saddam never had the chance to attack Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, or other allies in the region. By the end of the second week, our troops had reached the outskirts of Baghdad. They had endured blinding sandstorms, searing heat, and heavy hazmat gear to protect against the biological or chemical attack we feared. They faced fierce resistance from Saddam's most loyal forces, who attacked from civilian vehicles and hid behind human shields. Yet they completed the fastest armored advance in the history of warfare. Along the way, they handed out candy and medicine to children and risked their lives to protect Iraqi civilians. On April 4th, Sergeant Paul Ray Smith and his men were securing a courtyard near the Baghdad airport. Saddam's Republican guards ambushed them, wounding several of Sergeant Smith's men. Exposed to enemy fire, Sergeant Smith manned a machine gun and kept shooting until he suffered a mortal wound. The Army's after-action report revealed that he had killed 50 enemy soldiers and saved as many as 100 Americans. For his act of bravery, Paul Ray Smith became the first soldier in the War on Terror to earn the Medal of Honor. In April 2005, I presented the medal to his widow, Birgit, and young son at the White House. The day after Sergeant Smith gave his life to secure the airport, the 3rd Infantry Division entered Baghdad. The 1st Marine Division arrived 2 days later. At the NSC meeting on the morning of April 9th, Tommy Franks reported that the Iraqi capital could fall at any moment. My next meeting was with President Rudolf Schuster of Slovakia. His young democracy, one of 48 countries that had pledged military or logistical support in Iraq, had deployed a unit trained to manage the impact of a WMD attack. President Schuster had tears in his eyes as he described his nation's pride in helping liberate Iraq. I kept that moment in mind when I heard critics allege that America acted unilaterally. The false charge denigrated our allies and pissed me off. When the meeting ended, Dan Bartlett told me I ought to take a look at the TV. I didn't keep one in the Oval Office, so I went to the area outside where my personal assistant sat. I watched as a crowd of Iraqis in Baghdad's Firdaus Square cheered while a Marine vehicle dragged down a 40-foot-tall statue of Saddam. For 20 days, I had been filled with anxiety. Now, I was overwhelmed with relief and pride. I was also mindful of the challenges ahead. Saddam's forces still controlled parts of northern Iraq, including his hometown of Tikrit. There were pockets of resistance from ruthless Ba'athist fighters called Fedayeen Saddam, and Saddam and his sons were on the run. As I told Jose Maria Aznar when I called to share the news, you won't see us doing any victory dances or anything. I should have followed my own advice. Tommy Franks felt it was important to show that a new phase in the war had begun. As a way to do that, I decided to give a speech aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln, which was returning home after 10 months at sea. The 5,000 sailors, airmen, and Marines aboard the carrier had supported operations in both the Afghan and Iraqi theaters. On May 1, 2003, I climbed into the seat of a military jet for the first time in more than 30 years. Navy pilot Scott Zellum, known by his call sign as Z-Man, briefed us on the safety procedures at Naval Air Station North Island in San Diego. Commander John Skip Lucier, a fine pilot with more than 500 carrier landings on his resume, got our S-3B Viking off the ground. At one point, he handed the controls to me, and I flew the jet for a few minutes over the Pacific Ocean. I was rusty, but after a few porpoises, I steadied out. The commander wisely took over as we approached the carrier. He guided the plane down to the deck and caught the final arresting wire. Aboard the Lincoln, I visited with the landing crew, marveled at takeoffs and landings in the catapult zone, and ate chow with the sailors and Marines. "My fellow Americans," I said in my speech, "major combat operations in Iraq have ended. The transition from dictatorship to democracy will take time, but it is worth every effort. Our coalition will stay until our work is done. Then we will leave, and we will leave behind a free Iraq." I hadn't noticed the large banner my staff had placed on the bridge of the ship, positioned for TV. It read, "Mission Accomplished." It was intended as a tribute to the folks aboard the Lincoln, which had just completed the longest deployment for an aircraft carrier of its class. Instead, it looked like I was doing the victory dance I had warned against. "Mission Accomplished" became a shorthand criticism for all that subsequently went wrong in Iraq. My speech made clear that our work was far from done, but all the explaining in the world could not reverse the perception. Our stagecraft had gone awry. It was a big mistake. With Saddam gone from power, our central objective became helping the Iraqis develop a democracy that could govern itself, sustain itself, defend itself, and serve as an ally in the war on terror. The objective was ambitious, but I was optimistic. Many of the dire contingencies we had planned for and worried about before the war had not come to pass. There had been no Fortress Baghdad, no massive oil field fires, no widespread starvation, no civilian massacre by Saddam, no WMD attack on our troops, and no terrorist attack on America or our allies. There was one important contingency for which we had not adequately prepared. In the weeks after liberation, Baghdad descended into a state of lawlessness. I was appalled to see looters carrying precious artifacts out of Iraq's National Museum, and to read reports of kidnapping, murder, and rape. Part of the explanation was that Saddam had released tens of thousands of criminals shortly before the war. But the problem was deeper than that. Saddam had warped the psychology of Iraqis in a way we didn't fully understand. The suspicion and fear that he had cultivated for decades were rising to the surface. "What the hell is happening?" I asked during an NSC meeting in late April. "Why isn't anybody stopping these looters?" The short answer was that there was a manpower shortage in Baghdad. The Iraqi police force had collapsed when the regime fell. The Iraqi army had melted away. Because of Turkey's decision, many of the American troops who liberated Baghdad had been required to continue north to free the rest of the country. The damage done in those early days created problems that would linger for years. The Iraqis were looking for someone to protect them. By failing to secure Baghdad, we missed our first chance to show that we could. The security vacuum was accompanied by a political vacuum. I decided to name an American administrator to provide order while we worked to develop a legitimate government. The idea grew into the Coalition Provisional Authority, authorized by a United Nations resolution and led by a distinguished Foreign Service officer and counterterrorism expert, Ambassador L. Paul Jerry Bremer. Jerry impressed me from the start. He was an aggressive leader who shared my conviction that the Iraqis were capable of democracy. He knew it would take time for them to write a constitution and prepare for elections. In one of our first meetings, he told me he'd read a study of previous post-war operations and thought we needed more troops in Iraq. I raised the question of troop levels with Don Rumsfeld and the military leadership. They assured me we had enough. They anticipated the arrival of more forces from coalition partners and believed we could train an Iraqi army and police force fairly quickly. They were also concerned about stirring up Iraqi nationalism and inciting violence by appearing to occupy the country. I accepted Don and the military's judgment. The chaos and violence we witnessed was alarming, but it was still early. The situation reminded me of the difficult first days in Afghanistan. I refused to give up on our plan before it had a chance to work. Bremer arrived in Iraq on May 12, 2003. One of his first tasks was to assemble an Iraqi governing council that would take responsibility for key ministries and prepare for a formal return of sovereignty. Navigating Iraq's tribal, religious, and ethnic politics was highly complicated. But Jerry and his team did a superb job. The governing council took office in July, just 4 months after liberation. It included 25 Iraqis from all backgrounds. Iraqi still had a long way to go, but they had taken their first step toward a representative government. Forming the governing council was an important way to demonstrate that Saddam's tyranny was gone forever. With that in mind, Jerry issued two orders shortly after his arrival in Baghdad. One declared that certain members of Saddam's Ba'ath Party would not be eligible to serve in the new government of Iraq. The other formally disbanded the Iraqi army, which had largely disappeared on its own. In some ways, the orders achieved their objectives. Iraq's Shia and Kurds, the majority of the population, welcomed the clean break from Saddam. But the orders had a psychological impact I did not foresee. Many Sunnis took them as a signal they would have no place in Iraq's future. This was especially dangerous in the case of the army. Thousands of armed men had just been told they were not wanted. Instead of signing up for the new military, many joined the insurgency. In retrospect, I should have insisted on more debate on Jerry's orders, especially on what message disbanding the army would send and how many Sunnis the de-Ba'athification would affect. Overseen by longtime exile Ahmed Shalabi, the de-Ba'athification program turned out to cut much deeper than we expected, including mid-level party members like teachers. It is possible we would have issued the orders anyway. They were tough calls, and any alternative would have created a separate set of problems. Had the Shia concluded that we were not serious about ending the era of the Ba'ath Party, they may have turned against the coalition, rejected the goal of a unified Iraqi democracy, and aligned themselves with Iran. There is no way to know for sure what would have happened, but the discussion would have better prepared us for what followed. The security situation continued to deteriorate over the summer. Iraq was becoming a magnet for extremists, Ba'athist insurgents, Fedayeen Saddam, foreign terrorists affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and later militant Shia and agents of Iran. These groups had different ideologies, but they shared an immediate goal, to drive America out of Iraq. They knew they could never win a direct fight against our troops, so they deployed roadside bombs and attacked non-military targets, such as the Jordanian embassy and the UN complex in Baghdad. Another tactic was to kidnap reconstruction workers and execute them in grisly internet videos. Their strategy was to present an image of Iraq as hopeless and unwinnable, swinging American public opinion against the war and forcing us to withdraw, as we had in Vietnam. To an extent, they succeeded. It was difficult for the average American to differentiate the twisted terrorists from the millions of ordinary Iraqis who were grateful for liberation. We tried to get the good news out, the relative calm in the Kurdish north and the Shia south, the rebuilding of schools and hospitals, and the training of a new Iraqi army. But in the eyes of the media, and therefore of the public, none of this quiet progress could compete with the bombings and the beheadings. In early July, a reporter asked me about attacks on our troops. There are some who feel like that if they attack us, that we may decide to leave prematurely, I said. My answer is, bring them on. Anytime I spoke on Iraq, there were multiple audiences listening, each of which had a different perspective. I thought about four in particular. The first audience was the American people. Their support was essential to funding and fighting the war. I believed that most Americans wanted to win in Iraq, but if the cost seemed too high or victory too distant, they would grow weary. It was important for me to reinforce the importance of the cause and our determination to prevail. The second audience was our troops. They had volunteered to serve and were risking their lives far from home. They and their families needed to know I believed in them, stood firmly behind their mission, and would not make military decisions based on politics. The third audience was the Iraqi people. Some wanted us gone, but I was convinced that the vast majority of Iraqis wanted us to stay long enough to help a democratic society emerge. It was important that I communicate my resolve to complete the work we had begun. If Iraqis suspected we were going to abandon them, they would turn to other sources for protection. The final audience was the enemy. They believed their acts of savagery could affect our decisions. I had to make clear they never would. My bring 'em on comment was intended to show confidence in our troops and signal that the enemy could never shake our will. But the firestorm of criticism showed that I had left a wrong impression with other audiences. I learned from the experience and paid closer attention to how I communicated with each audience in the years ahead. By the fall of 2003, the international coalition in Iraq was comprised of ground forces from 30 countries, including two multinational divisions led by Great Britain and Poland, and logistical support from many others. Coalition forces had discovered torture chambers, rape rooms, and mass graves containing thousands of bodies. They found a facility containing state-of-the-art hazmat suits and syringes with the antidote for VX nerve agent. But they had not found the stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons that virtually every major intelligence agency in the world believed Saddam had. When Saddam didn't use WMD on our troops, I was relieved. When we didn't discover the stockpiles soon after the fall of Baghdad, I was surprised. When the whole summer passed without finding any, I was alarmed. The press corps constantly raised the question, where are the WMD? I was asking the same thing. The military and intelligence teams assured me they were looking constantly. They examined hidden sites Saddam had used during the Gulf War. They collected intelligence and responded to tips. At one point, the CIA heard that large canisters had been spotted from a bridge over the Euphrates River. Navy frogmen deployed to the scene. They found nothing. A high-ranking official from the United Arab Emirates brought drawings of tunnels he believed Saddam had used to hide weapons. We dug up the ground. Nothing materialized. George Tenet recruited David Kay, the UN's chief weapons inspector in Iraq in 1991, to lead a new inspections team. Kay conducted a thorough search of Iraq and found irrefutable evidence that Saddam had lied to the world and violated Resolution 1441. Iraq's WMD programs spanned more than two decades, involved thousands of people, billions of dollars, and were elaborately shielded by security and deception operations that continued even beyond the end of Operation Iraqi Freedom, he told Congress in October 2003. But there was one thing Kay did not find, the WMD stockpiles everyone expected. The left trotted out a new mantra, Bush lied, people died. The charge was illogical. If I wanted to mislead the country into war, why would I pick an allegation that was certain to be disproven publicly shortly after we invaded the country? The charge was also dishonest. Members of the previous administration, John Kerry, John Edwards, and the vast majority of Congress, had all read the same intelligence that I had and concluded Iraq had WMD. So had intelligence agencies around the world. Nobody was lying. We were all wrong. The absence of WMD stockpiles did not change the fact that Saddam was a threat. In January 2004, David Kay said, "It was reasonable to conclude that Iraq posed an imminent threat. What we learned during the inspection made Iraq a more dangerous place potentially than in fact we thought it was even before the war." Still, I knew the failure to find WMD would transform public perception of the war. While the world was undoubtedly safer with Saddam gone, the reality was that I had sent American troops into combat based in large part on intelligence that proved false. That was a massive blow to our credibility. My credibility. That would shake the confidence of the American people. No one was more shocked or angry than I was when we didn't find the weapons. I had a sickening feeling every time I thought about it. I still do. While the fight in Iraq was more difficult than I expected, I remained optimistic. I was inspired by the courage of the 100,000 Iraqis who volunteered to join their security forces, by leaders who stepped forward to replace members of the governing council who had been assassinated, and by ordinary people who longed for freedom. Nothing gave me more confidence than our troops. Thanks to them, most of the senior members of Saddam's regime had been captured or killed by the end of 2003. In July, we got an intelligence tip that Saddam's two sons were in the Mosul area of northern Iraq. Joined by special forces, troops from the 101st Airborne under the command of General David Petraeus laid siege to the building where Hussein's sons, Uday and Qusay, were hiding. After a six-hour firefight, both were dead. We later received intelligence that Saddam had ordered the killing of Barbara and Jenna in return for the death of his sons. 2 days after the fall of Baghdad, Laura and I visited Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington and the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda. We met with almost 100 wounded service members and their families. Some were from Afghanistan. Many were from Iraq. It was a heart-wrenching experience to look into a hospital bed and see the consequences of sending Americans into combat. One comfort was that I knew they would receive superb medical care from the skilled and compassionate professionals of the military healthcare system. At Walter Reed, I met a member of the Delta Team, one of our elite special forces units. For classification reasons, I cannot give his name. He had lost the lower half of his leg. "I appreciate your service," I said as I shook his hand. "I'm sorry you got hurt." "Don't feel sorry for me, Mr. President," he replied. "Just get me another leg so I can go back in." At the National Naval Medical Center, I met 42-year-old Marine Master Gunnery Sergeant Guadalupe de Noguian. He had been wounded a few weeks earlier when a rocket-propelled grenade struck his vehicle. The explosion blew off part of his skull in his right hand. Shrapnel penetrated his upper back and legs, and his eardrums burst. When asked if he had any requests, Guadalupe said he had two. He asked for a promotion for the corporal who had saved his life, and he wanted to become an American citizen. After 9/11, I had issued an executive order making all foreign nationals serving in the military eligible for immediate citizenship. Guadalupe had come to the United States from Mexico as a boy. He picked fruit to help his family make a living until he joined the Marines at age 17. After serving for 25 years and deploying for two wars with Iraq, he wanted the flag on his uniform to be his own. That day in the hospital, Laura and I attended his naturalization ceremony, conducted by Director Eduardo Aguirre of the Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services. Guadalupe raised his right hand, covered in bandages, and swore the oath of citizenship. A few months later, he was followed by Marine Lance Corporal O.J. Santa Maria, a native of the Philippines. He was 21 years old and had suffered a serious wound in Iraq. He was hooked up to an intravenous blood transfusion. About halfway through the ceremony, he broke down in tears. He powered through to the end of the oath. I was proud to respond, "My fellow American." In the fall of 2003, Andy Card came to me with an idea. Was I interested in making a trip to Iraq to thank the troops? You bet I was. The risk was high, but Deputy Chief of Staff Joe Hagan, working with the Secret Service and White House Military Office, came up with a way to pull it off. The week of Thanksgiving, I would travel to Crawford and tell the press I was staying for the full holiday. Then, on Wednesday night, I would slip out of the ranch and fly to Baghdad. I told Laura several weeks ahead of the trip. She was reassured when I told her we would abort the trip if news of it leaked. I told Barbara and Jenna about 30 minutes before I left. "I'm scared, Dad," Barbara said. "Be safe. Come home." Condi and I climbed into an unmarked Suburban, our baseball caps pulled low, and headed for the airport. To maintain secrecy, there was no motorcade. I had nearly forgotten what a traffic jam felt like. But riding on I-35 the day before Thanksgiving brought the memories back. We crept along, passing an occasional car full of counter-assault agents, and made it to Air Force One on schedule. Timeliness was important. We needed to land as the sun was setting in Baghdad. We flew from Texas to Andrews Air Force Base, where we switched to the twin version of Air Force One and took off for Iraq. The plane carried a skeleton crew of staff, military, and Secret Service personnel, and a press contingent sworn to secrecy. I slept little on the 10.5-hour flight. As we neared Baghdad, I showered, shaved, and headed to the cockpit to watch the landing. Colonel Mark Tillman manned the controls. I trusted him completely. As Laura always put it, "That Mark can sure land this plane." With the sun dropping on the horizon, I could make out the minarets of the Baghdad skyline. The city seemed so serene from above. But we were concerned about surface-to-air missiles on the ground. While Joe Hagan assured us the military had cleared a wide perimeter around Baghdad International Airport, the mood aboard the plane was anxious. As we descended in a corkscrew pattern with the shades drawn, some staffers joined together in a prayer session. At the last moment, Colonel Tillman leveled out the plane and kissed the runway, no sweat. Waiting for me at the airport were Jerry Bremer and General Ricardo Sanchez, the senior ground commander in Iraq. "Welcome to a free Iraq," Jerry said. We went to the mess hall where 600 troops had gathered for a Thanksgiving meal. Jerry was supposed to be the guest of honor. He told the troops he had a holiday message from the president. "Let's see if we've got anybody more senior here," he said. That was my cue. I walked out from behind a curtain and onto the stage of the packed hall. Many of the stunned troops hesitated for a split second, then let out deafening whoops and hoo-ahs. Some had tears running down their faces. I was swept up by the emotion. These were the souls who just 8 months earlier had liberated Iraq on my orders. Many had seen combat. Some had seen friends perish. I took a deep breath and said, "I bring a message on behalf of America. We thank you for your service. We're proud of you, and America stands solidly behind you." After the speech, I had dinner with the troops and moved to a side room to meet with four members of the governing council, the mayor of Baghdad, and members of the city council. One woman, the director of a maternity hospital, told me how women had more opportunities now than they had ever dreamed about under Saddam. I knew Iraq still faced big problems, but the trip reinforced my faith that they could be overcome. The most dangerous part left was the takeoff from Baghdad. We were told to keep all lights out and maintain total telephone silence until we hit 10,000 feet. I was still on an emotional high, but the exhilaration of the moment was replaced by an eerie feeling of uncertainty as we blasted off the ground and climbed silently through the night. After a few tense minutes, we reached a safe altitude. I called one of the operators on the plane and asked him to connect me with Laura. "Where are you?" she asked. "I'm on the way home," I said. "Tell the girls all is well." She sounded relieved. It turns out she'd had a little mix-up with the timing. She couldn't remember whether I said I would be in the air at 10 a.m. or noon. At 10:15, she had called a Secret Service agent at the ranch and asked if he had heard from President Bush. "Let me check," the agent said. A few seconds passed. "Yes, ma'am," he replied. "They are 90 minutes away." She realized he was talking about Mother and Dad, who are on their way to spend Thanksgiving with us. "No, I mean my George," she said. The agent paused. "Well, ma'am," he said, "we show he is in the ranch house." Secrecy was so tight that the agents on the ranch were still unaware that I had slipped away for the most thrilling trip of my presidency. On Saturday, December 13th, Don Rumsfeld called. He had just spoken to General John Abizade, who had replaced Tommy Franks after his retirement in July. John was a cerebral Lebanese-American general who spoke Arabic and understood the Middle East. John believed we had captured Saddam Hussein. Before we announced it to the world, he had to be 100% sure. The next morning, Condi called back to confirm the report. It was Saddam. His tattoos, three blue dots near his wrist, a symbol of his tribe, provided the telltale evidence. I was elated. Getting Saddam would be a big lift for our troops and for the American people. It would also make a psychological difference for the Iraqis, many of whom feared he would return. Now it was clear. The era of the dictator was over forever. Several months later, four men came to see me at the White House. They were members of the Delta team that had captured Saddam. They told me the story of the hunt. Intelligence pointed them to a farm near Saddam's hometown of Tikrit. As the soldiers combed the grounds, one discovered a hole. He climbed in and pulled out a disheveled, angry man. "My name is Saddam Hussein," the man said. "I am the president of Iraq, and I want to negotiate." "Regards from President Bush," the soldier replied. Saddam had three weapons with him, including a pistol that the men presented to me in a glass box. I told them I would display the gift in the private study off the Oval Office, and one day in my presidential library. The pistol always reminded me that a brutal dictator responsible for so much death and suffering had surrendered to our troops while cowering in a hole. As I record these thoughts more than 7 years after American troops liberated Iraq, I strongly believe that removing Saddam from power was the right decision. For all the difficulties that followed, America is safer without a homicidal dictator pursuing WMD and supporting terror at the heart of the Middle East. The region is more hopeful, with a young democracy setting an example for others to follow. And the Iraqi people are better off with a government that answers to them instead of torturing and murdering them. As we hoped, the liberation of Iraq had an impact beyond its borders. 6 days after Saddam's capture, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, a longtime enemy of America and state sponsor of terror, publicly confessed that he had been developing chemical and nuclear weapons. He pledged to dismantle his WMD programs along with related missiles under a system of strict international verification. It's possible the timing was a coincidence, but I don't think so. The war also led to consequences we did not intend. Over the years, I've spent a great deal of time thinking about what went wrong in Iraq and why. I have concluded that we made two errors that account for many of the setbacks we faced. The first is that we did not respond more quickly or aggressively when the security situation started to deteriorate after Saddam's regime fell. In the 10 months following the invasion, we cut troop levels from 192,000 to 109,000. Many of the remaining troops focused on training the Iraqi army and police, not protecting the Iraqi people. We worried we would create resentment by looking like occupiers. We believed we could train Iraqi security forces to lead the fight. And we thought progress toward a representative democracy Giving Iraqis of all backgrounds a stake in their country was the best path to lasting security. While there was logic behind these assumptions, the Iraqi people's desire for security trumped their aversion to occupation. One of the ironies of the war is that we were criticized harshly by the left and some in the international community for wanting to build an empire in Iraq. We never sought that. In fact, we were so adverse to anything that looked like an empire that we made our job far more difficult. By reducing our troop presence and focusing on training Iraqis, we inadvertently allowed the insurgency to gain momentum. Then Al-Qaeda fighters flocked to Iraq, seeking a new safe haven, which made our mission both more difficult and more important. Cutting troop levels too quickly was the most important failure of execution in the war. Ultimately, we adapted our strategy and fixed the problems, despite almost universal pressure to abandon Iraq. It took 4 painful, costly years to do so. At the time, progress felt excruciatingly slow. But history's perspective is broader. If Iraq is a functioning democracy 50 years from now, those 4 hard years might look a lot different. The other era was the intelligence failure on Iraq's WMD. Almost a decade later, it is hard to describe how widespread an assumption it was that Saddam had WMD. Supporters of the war believed it. Opponents of the war believed it. Even members of Saddam's own regime believed it. We all knew that intelligence is never 100% certain. That's the nature of the business. But I believed that the intelligence on Iraq's WMD was solid. If Saddam didn't have WMD, why wouldn't he just prove it to the inspectors? Every psychological profile I had read told me Saddam was a survivor. If he cared so much about staying in power, why would he gamble his regime by pretending to have WMD? Part of the explanation came after Saddam's capture, when he was debriefed by the FBI. He told agents that he was more worried about looking weak to Iran than being removed by the coalition. He never thought the United States would follow through on our promises to disarm him by force. I'm not sure what more I could have done to show Saddam I meant what I said. I named him part of an axis of evil in my State of the Union address. I spoke to a packed chamber of the United Nations and promised to disarm him by force if diplomacy failed. We presented him with a unanimous Security Council resolution. We sought and received strong bipartisan backing from the U.S. Congress. We deployed 150,000 troops to his border. I gave him a final 48 hours notice that we were about to invade his country. How much clearer could I have been? It's true that Saddam was getting mixed signals from France, Germany, and Russia, and from anti-war demonstrators around the world. That didn't help. But the war is not their fault. There was one person with the power to avoid war, and he chose not to use it. For all his deception of the world, the person Saddam ultimately deceived the most was himself. I decided early on that I would not criticize the hard-working patriots at the CIA for the faulty intelligence on Iraq. I did not want to repeat the nasty finger-pointing investigations that devastated the morale of the intelligence community in the 1970s. But I did want to know why the information I received was wrong and how we could prevent a similar mistake in the future. I appointed a nonpartisan commission co-chaired by Judge Larry Silberman and former Democratic Senator Chuck Robb to study the question. Their investigation produced valuable recommendations, such as increasing coordination between agencies and publishing more dissenting opinions. That will make intelligence more reliable for future presidents without undermining our intelligence community's ability to do its job. The nature of history is that we know the consequences only of the action we took. But inaction would have had consequences, too. Imagine what the world would look like today with Saddam Hussein still ruling Iraq. He would still be threatening his neighbors, sponsoring terror, and piling bodies into mass graves. The rising price of oil, which jumped from just over $30 a barrel in 2003 to almost $140 a barrel 5 years later, would have left Saddam awash in wealth. The sanctions, already falling apart, almost certainly would have crumbled. Saddam still had the infrastructure and know-how to make WMD. And as the final weapons inspections report by Charles Dulfer concluded, Saddam wanted to recreate Iraq's WMD capability after sanctions were removed and Iraq's economy stabilized. Had Saddam followed through on that intention, the world would likely have witnessed a nuclear arms race between Iraq and Iran. Saddam could have turned to Sunni terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, a marriage of convenience, not ideology, as surrogates in an attempt to match Iran's use of Shia terrorist groups like Hezbollah. The chance of biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists would have increased. The pressure on our friends in the region, especially Israel, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, would have been intense, and the American people would be much less secure today. Instead, as a result of our actions in Iraq, one of America's most committed and dangerous enemies stopped threatening us forever. The most volatile region in the world lost one of its greatest sources of violence and mayhem. Hostile nations around the world saw the cost of supporting terror and pursuing WMD. And in the space of 9 months, 25 million Iraqis went from living under a dictatorship of fear to seeing the prospect of a peaceful, functioning democracy. In December 2003, the Iraqis were still a long way from that dream, but they had a chance, and that was a lot more than they'd had before. The hardest days of the war were still ahead. In January 2004, our troops intercepted a letter from Zarqawi to senior Al-Qaeda leaders. He wrote about the growing pressure he was feeling and laid out his plan for survival. "We need to bring the Shia into the battle," he wrote, "because it is the only way to prolong the duration of the fight between the infidels and us." He set a new goal for the jihadists in Iraq, igniting a sectarian war. Chapter 9, Leading. Tonight in this hall, we resolve to be the party not of repose, but of reform. We will write not footnotes, but chapters in the American story. We will add the work of our hands to the inheritance of our fathers and mothers and leave this nation greater than we found it. If you give me your trust, I will honor it. Grant me a mandate, I will use it. Give me the opportunity to lead this nation, and I will lead. I meant the words I spoke at the Republican National Convention in 2000. When I entered politics, I made a decision. I would confront problems, not pass them on to future generations. I admired presidents who used their time in office to enact transformative change. I had studied Theodore Roosevelt, who served in the White House almost exactly a century before me. He had taken on the financial trusts, built a powerful navy, and launched the conservation movement. I also learned from Ronald Reagan, who combined an optimistic demeanor with the moral clarity and conviction to cut taxes, strengthen the military, and face down the Soviet Union despite withering criticism throughout his presidency. One of the lessons I took from Roosevelt and Reagan was to lead the public, not chase the opinion polls. I decided to push for sweeping reforms, not tinker with the status quo. As I told my advisors, I didn't take this job to play small ball. 2 weeks after we moved into the White House, Laura and I held our first movie night in the family theater. Situated on the ground floor of the White House, the theater features 46 comfortable chairs and a 93-square-foot projection screen. The Motion Picture Association of America, led for years by a fascinating Texan, Jack Valenti, generously made movies available to the first family. We never had to sit through coming attractions. For our first screening, Laura and I chose 13 Days, about President Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The movie was a fitting choice for our guest of honor, Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts. On the surface, Ted and I didn't have a whole lot in common. He was liberal. I was conservative. He grew up on Cape Cod. I was raised in West Texas. He had spent almost 40 years on Capitol Hill. I was relatively new to town. Ted and I did share what Laura called the family business. My grandfather, Prescott Bush, had represented Connecticut in the Senate at the same time John F. Kennedy had represented Massachusetts. Laura and I enjoyed meeting Ted's wife, Vicky, son Patrick, a congressman from Rhode Island, and niece Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, the lieutenant governor of Maryland, along with her daughter, Kate. Ted was friendly, gracious, and full of life. He had the trademark Kennedy accent and a great Irish glow. His smile came easily and often gave way to a big, warm laugh. I felt a connection to history as we watched a movie about how his brothers had defused a crisis from the West Wing. The movie hadn't been my only purpose for inviting Ted. He was the ranking Democrat on the Senate committee that drafted education legislation. He had sent signals that he was interested in my school reform proposal, No Child Left Behind. Ted and I were both appalled by the results coming from our public schools. In the competitive global economy, good jobs demanded knowledge and skills, but American students routinely trailed their peers in key subjects. On an international math test comparing 21 countries, America's high school seniors placed ahead of only Cyprus and South Africa. Part of the problem was that millions of children were shuffled from one grade to the next without anybody asking what they had learned. Many came from poor and minority backgrounds. In 2000, nearly 70% of fourth graders from high poverty backgrounds couldn't read at grade level. Some 40% of minority students failed to finish high school in 4 years. How could a society that promised equal opportunity for all quit on its neediest citizens? Starting in the 2000 campaign, I had called the problem the soft bigotry of low expectations. I had promised to take on the big issues. This was sure one of them. In recent years, the national education debate had bogged down in modest proposals like school uniforms and unrealistic calls to abolish the Department of Education. Success was often defined by dollars spent, not results achieved. I'd come from a world where accountability was a daily reality. In baseball, any interested party can open the newspaper, analyze your performance in a box score, and demand change. More pitching, Bush, was a familiar refrain. Education was a lot more important than baseball, yet most people had no idea how their schools were performing. As governor, I worked with the legislature to pass a law requiring schools to test students on the basics every year, report the results publicly, and allow parents to transfer their children out of underperforming schools. Between 1994 and 1998, the percentage of third graders performing at grade level grew from 58 to 76. Minority students showed the largest gains, closing the achievement gap with their white peers. When I ran for president, I decided to propose federal legislation that set clear goals. Every child would learn to read and do math at grade level, and held schools accountable for progress. Under No Child Left Behind, states would test students in reading and math every year between third and eighth grade, and once in high school. Schools would post scores publicly, broken down by ethnicity, income level, and other subcategories. The data would allow parents and concerned citizens to evaluate schools, teachers, and curricula. Schools that scored below standards would receive extra help at first, including money for students to attend after-school tutoring, public or private. But if schools repeatedly failed to make adequate progress, there would be consequences. Parents would have the option to transfer their child to a better-performing public or charter school. The principle was straightforward. You cannot solve a problem until you diagnose it. Accountability would serve as a catalyst for reform. I highlighted No Child Left Behind at almost every campaign event, including the NAACP convention. I told reporters I hoped to be known as the education president. I told Ted Kennedy the same thing the night we watched 13 Days. I don't know about you, but I like to surprise people, I said. Let's show them Washington can still get things done. The next morning, a letter arrived in the Oval Office. Dear Mr. President, You and Mrs. Bush couldn't have been more gracious and generous to Vicky and me and the members of our family last night and these past few days. I very much appreciate your thoughtful consideration. Like you, I have every intention of getting things done, particularly in education and health care. We will have a difference or two along the way, but I look forward to some important Rose Garden signings. Warm regards, Ted Kennedy. I was excited. No Child Left Behind stood a much better chance of becoming law with support from the Lion of the Senate. It was the beginning of my most unlikely partnership in Washington. Ted Kennedy was not the only legislator I courted. Over my first 2 weeks in office, I met with more than 150 members of Congress from both parties. I hoped to replicate the productive relationship I'd forged with Bob Bullock, Pete Laney, and other legislators in Texas. One news story began, "If relations between Congress and the White House soon deteriorate into bitterness as usual, it won't be for lack of effort to avoid that by President Bush." Another suggested that I was conducting the biggest charm offensive of any modern chief executive. Whatever the press called my effort, both houses of Congress soon took up No Child Left Behind. By March, the Senate Education Committee had completed a bill that included all the key elements of my proposal. The House moved next. Congressman John Boehner of Ohio, the skilled Republican chairman of the House Education Committee, collaborated on a solid bill with Congressman George Miller of California, one of the chamber's most liberal members. The House passed it by a vote of 384 to 45. The process of reconciling the House and Senate bills dragged through the summer. When Congress returned from recess in early September, I set out to re-energize the debate with 2 days of school visits in Florida. Laura agreed to give her first ever testimony on Capitol Hill. As a teacher and librarian, she had great credibility on education. Her appearance was scheduled for September 11, 2001. By the end of that morning, it was clear I would not be the education president. I was a war president. Throughout the fall, I urged Congress to finish No Child Left Behind. Ted Kennedy gave a courageous speech defending accountability in front of the National Education Association, a teachers' group that contributed heavily to Democrats and strongly opposed the bill. Senator Judd Gregg and Congressman Boehner, once an advocate of abolishing the Education Department, rallied Republicans who were anxious about the federal role in education. Like me, they argued that if we were going to spend money on schools, we ought to know the results it produced. A week before Christmas, Congress passed No Child Left Behind by a bipartisan landslide. Over the years, No Child Left Behind prompted plenty of controversy. Governors and state education officials complained that the bureaucracy was too rigid and that too many schools were labeled as failing. When Margaret Spellings became education secretary in 2005, she modified bureaucratic restrictions and increased flexibility for states. But we both made clear we would not dilute the accountability measures. The purpose of the law was to reveal the truth, even when it was unpleasant. Some